prepare yourselves for Ethan and Aaron's Confessions of a Movie Snob, the ongoing discussion of film genres.
Ladies and gentlemen, trees and multiforms, welcome to the podcast. I am Aaron. That is...
Ethan.
That is Ethan. And we are the Thin, Fat, Gay, Married, Inclined Marines. Damn it, aren't we?
We are.
See, we are thin and fat and gay and married. No, not Anglican or Marines, so I guess 1, 2, 3 out of 4 isn't bad or something like that. But welcome back to the podcast. We've had, what, a 2-week break now?
Yep, that sounds about right.
Yeah, I pulled all my hair out because I was going nuts. I was sick the week before last, and then this week I was, we were giving thanks for stuff, I guess, or eating, one or the other.
Yes.
One of the others. But tonight we're gonna keep it going. That's what we're doing. Is we've had so much fun talking about the different films of the past couple of decades that we decided to just keep on keeping on with it. And we are going to be discussing the films of the 1980s tonight, the final decade that Ethan and I lived all the way through. So
yes,
when we get into my list, that definitely shaped my list. But we'll get into that a little bit more as we get moving. So, but before we get into any of that, we have our little segment that we like to call Geekly Happenings, News Relevant to Us Geeks. Now, with this, as we stated before in the past, we are trying to move away from this a little bit, but there is some stuff going on, and we are going to want to talk about it. Is there anything that jumps out at you out of all the news that's come out in the last few weeks, Ethan?
Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen confirmed to be in X-Men Days of Future Past.
That's true.
Which obviously, you could read into that saying it's flashbacks or, there is that whole it's in the future type of thing. So it's cool to see them back. And also, obviously, Bryan Singer is back to direct.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think we talked about.
We did talk about that. We talked about it last show we did, I believe. No, we did it on the... it was the last show we did. Mm-hmm. It was the one we did with Noah. We talked about it on there.
That's right.
Some people are super happy about this. I haven't really seen anybody that's really particularly pissed off that Stewart and McKellen are coming back, but there are some people that are just all like, boo to Days of Future Past. And
yeah. I can't really understand that. That was a good one, I thought.
It was fine, but it's still an X-Men story. So, that's going to hurt it. That's going to hurt it. That's cool, though. I like both those people. I like both those people quite a bit, as a matter of fact. And I did like those movies, despite the fact that, they're those movies. Now, everything else that I'm thinking about is all Star Wars related. Is there anything besides that we need to talk about?
No. The other thing I saw was Star Wars related. So
yeah, I got... kind of more than two things, but we're going to get into the positives and then we'll get into the negatives. The positives meaning we actually know something, is we have a confirmed by Lucasfilm Limited writer, and it is Michael, I don't know how to say his name, Arndt, A-R-N-D-T, he's the guy that
Arndt,
wrote,
yeah.
Arndt, he wrote Toy Story 3, which is, I think, my favorite film of the year that it came out in, Little Miss Sunshine, Rock of Ages, I liked that one quite a bit, and I'm all about that Toy Story 3 connection there myself.
Oh yeah,
and Little Miss Sunshine was a nice little movie. I thought it was a tad overrated, but it just made me feel dirty watching it at the end, even though it's supposed to make you feel joyous, and I don't know about all that, but that's good. So that is an absolute 100% certainty that Michael Arndt has already written a draft and has been turned in, and now he's working on revisions and whatnot. Now, this is one of the reasons why I was so excited about the Star Wars news, is because I knew this was going to be the news that kept on giving. And boy, has it ever. So we got that. We're into the Michael Arndt is the screenplay writer for Star Wars Episode 7. Cool, mm-hmm. We'll see what happens. Then we're going to get into the, I don't know, if, we're not going to call it speculation, but there is... I don't know if we want to call them rumblings or what, but... they are apparently discussing writing episodes 8 and 9 with Lawrence Kasdan, the writer of Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. Mm-hmm. So, I like Empire. I like Jedi. so that'd be good. That was something that I wasn't really sure of because I saw it all over the news, but I couldn't find like any, I couldn't find anything beyond the fact that, you know, that this is, you know, highly, this is like a very open secret, so to speak.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be all for it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, kind of. I mean, that was, what, 30 years ago, and, you know, maybe he can still write a good movie. Who knows?
Yeah, well, he directed some fine movies, too. You know, I mean, Silverado showed up during our Western show, and that was good.
Oh, what's his face? John Rogers is a big fan of him. You know, he talked about him a whole bunch in our noir show that we did. Okay, now other than that, we've talked about some writers here, and now we're going to get into directors of the Star Wars Episode 7. And this isn't news so much as that it's funny to me. We know a bunch of people that aren't directing Star Wars Episode 7. Whole bunch of people that aren't. I got my little article. Where's it at? We know that Steven Spielberg is not, and I cannot find his direct quote, but his direct quote was something like, "No, I will not be directing it. It's not my genre. It is my friend George's, and I would not want to touch it." Quentin Tarantino's, I really want to find it. I want to find this. He says, I could so care less. No, sorry, especially if Disney's going to do it. I'm not interested in the Simon West version of Star Wars. Mm-hmm. So that's a no, I'm not directing it. And then... the weird one, I don't know if I'm going to call it weird, but it's like a flat-out turn-down, is Zack Snyder. And he says, I don't think I'd be interested in directing it. I'm a huge Star Wars fanatic. I just think that doing Episode 7, 8, and 9 is just a slippery slope. It's a whole other mythological element I'm excited to see, but it's a lot of effort. And then we also know that Brad Bird turned it down. That was one that kind of piqued my interest a little bit, you know, because it would have been like the Toy Story connection all the way through. And, you know, while, like I have said, that, and I still stand firm on that, that I want to see a new, undiscovered talent directing these, and I'm still right there. Although after I said that, I decided that I thought it would be kind of cool if Spielberg directed it, but he turned it down, so now I'm back to the, you know, I want to see a new person direct it. And the name that won't seem to go away is Matthew Vaughn, the director of X-Men First Class. And did he do X-Men 3?
No. He was supposed to do.
Who the hell?
He was supposed
that was
to do
that was Ratner. That was
Ratner. I think.
Yeah. He did. He did that. He did. Layer Cake, and he did Kick-Ass. That's one that like popped up, and it hasn't gone away. Like Christopher Nolan also turned it down. What's funny is
J.J. Abrams.
So did J.J. Abrams. What's funny is, well, I don't know if I'm going to call it funny, but these names will pop up and they'll be around for like a day or so, and then the news gets shot down. You know, like Steven Spielberg being talked to, and he says, no, Tarantino, you know, fuck you. And then, you know, just like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the Matthew Vaughn one popped up before any of these, and that hasn't been shut down yet. So,
because the big speculation is he dropped out of directing Days of Future Past.
I could see.
And so there's some speculation there.
I mean, I guess. I'm not particularly opposed to the idea. But,
no.
But at the same time, you know, he's not an unknown talent that I've never heard of. So okay. See, other than that, do we have anything else?
Nope, I don't have anything else. We'll get right on into it.
Yep, just like the whole Star Wars news thing, because I expect this to be like, you know, just here for a very long time and keep giving us interesting news. We'll see what happens. But the reason why we're here, folks, tonight is we are going to be discussing a it's not a genre. It's a decade of movies that I actually found. This is one, like, when we decided we're going to start doing this, it was the first one that popped up in my head. But not because I was particularly interested in doing it, because I just thought that this was Ethan's time to shine with the 1980s. I don't know. I think about you, and I think of the 80s action movies, and I also know that some of your more favorite movies that ever came out in the 1980s. And so, you know, with me, yeah, I like some movies from the 80s, but it doesn't necessarily jump out of my mind as my decade. This one does jump out in yours, or rather, for yours, for me.
Yeah, well, your favorite movie of all time came out in 1980.
It did. It came out in 1980, but at the same time, you know, I'm off the top of my head, it seems like three or four of yours came out in the 1980s. I'm thinking one of mine came out in 80. I don't remember. But we just got to see what happens here. Now, like I said in our little in our intro part of this, is this is going to be an interesting list for me, like I said, because this is the decade that we grew up in. You know, this is not the, you know, like the 2000s, we were in our 20s, and the 90 to 2000, we were, you know, 10 to 20. This is like, you know, I think I was a couple of months old, and you were like a week old in 1980, yeah. You know, through 10. So it should be interesting because I look at this, and I don't have any, like, those big hoity-toity, I'm a special, artsy-fartsy guy. I mean, these are all movies that meant a lot to me growing up. Now, in terms of the 1980s, Ethan, what jumps out to you about the movies? Like, at least a lot of the movies that came out in this time period.
It was a big exploration in special effects. Computers are becoming a big element to movie making, and a lot of people were experimenting with that. But at the same time, you had these sort of sword and sorcery or these low-budget slasher films that were coming out at the same time. And I think the biggest influence in movies in the 1980s has to be home video.
Yeah, that's the truth.
Because VCRs became so prevalent and everything, and really it was a time where people grew from having this movie experience to being able to say, well, I'm going to get that on video when it comes out by the end of the decade, you know. So
by
it was
the end
a big
of the decade, for
shifting.
Sure. I remember when I was, you know, 5, 6, 7, we would go out and rent a VCR. You know, we would go to the Servotronics on 23rd and Louisiana. It was like the only place in town you could rent one. We'd rent that, and we'd rent a whole bunch of like different video cassettes and stuff. And yeah, that's a definite memory from the man. I haven't thought about that in a long time. But yeah, that was back when VCRs were $1,000 and the tapes were $350 a piece.
And those big top loader VCRs
or Betamax.
Yeah. And it was a time where the movie industry changed from having this mentality of making movies for the screen to saying, well, now there's another life for these on video cassette, you know, that this is another revenue stream or this is another way people are watching these.
Well, it's kind of like everything in the 1980s. I mean, it was a really big time for the business of movies, the show, like the business of the show business, so to speak. I mean, because, you know, you would have stuff like it was when merchandising, when film was really starting to take off. You know, you had Star Wars 3 years previously, and, you know, obviously that led to, you know, all the action figures and lunch.
Yeah, but it wasn't as injected into movies as it became in the 80s.
No, absolutely not. You know, it came to be. I mean, it's just like everything else. You know, it starts honestly, and it starts as a way, you know, of something like actually trying to, you know, to fill a demand. You know, people wanted those Star Wars figures. People wanted those, you know, the Jaws board games and stuff like that. But it got into the 80s, and, you know, the market got oversaturated. And it's just ridiculous now. I mean, you know, you see action figures for fucking movies now that we would have never dreamed about seeing when we were growing up. You know, stuff like that. So, but you're absolutely right. There's a lot of exploration in technologies and stuff like that. Obviously, you know, you have your, you know, what year did Wrath of Khan come out?
82,
yeah.
I think.
So we did have our first CGI scene ever in film history. So that's a good thing. We had a lot of, you know, a lot of passing of the torch, so to speak. You know, I keep running into this because, like, a lot of this was more like the late 70s, but you had people coming into their own because, you know, like in the 70s, we discovered people like, you know, Coppola, like Lucas, like Spielberg, like De Palma, like stuff like that. But they really came into their own and they, like, you know, they took the torch, so to speak, from the previous generation of filmmakers.
Well, you could definitely say that in the 1970s was sort of an evolution of movies from in their method of storytelling and sort of the stories that they could tell, whereas the 1980s was a evolution of the way they could tell those stories.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was getting to the point where you could do almost anything that you wanted to on film, and, you know, obviously that's something that they still say today. So, you know, finally now with computer technology we can do, you know, exactly what we want. But, you know, a lot of people are thinking the same thing, you know, what with motion control cameras, with, you know, just highly, highly, highly detailed miniatures. And, you know, and actually studios putting the money in there to where they can spend that time on some of these miniatures and stuff like that, to where it really was an interesting time of it was an interesting time in film. I mean, it was kind of a transitionary period, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, you know, you had your anti-heroes and stuff like that going on in the 70s. In the 90s, you had a lot of the, you know, like the seeds that were planted in the 1980s, like, really come to fruition. What with the, you know, like Terminator 2. Like, yeah, at the end of the 90s, you had stuff like the Star Wars prequels, and you had the Die Hard sequels. And, you know, you had a lot of this stuff to where, you know, that was the plan, that they wanted to build these franchises. Well, a lot of these franchises did get built, and, you know, we were starting to see what happened because of that. So it was an interesting decade. Now, this isn't one that I'm able to talk about as well as I would like, because, like I said, I was growing up. You know, I was going to school. I wasn't seeing as many movies. I didn't have a car. You know, stuff like that. But it's still, there's a lot of movies in this decade that I really do love a lot. So it's going to be interesting to talk about it for sure.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to it.
Why don't we just get started on it? Ethan, what's your number six?
All right. Well, diving in, when I was sort of generating this list, I mean, I quickly realized there's tons of great movies that came out in the 1980s that I love and cherish and really really enjoy today. And narrowing that down to a list of 10 was pretty hard, especially for me.
Yeah.
This is definitely one of those eras of or decades of movies that a lot came out that I just. That just, you know, clicked with me. So my number six going into it is actually the 1998 Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
1988 Who Framed Roger Rabbit is my number six.
Well, there you
Robert
go.
Zemeckis. Yep.
Robert Zemeckis. An amazing movie, you know, and it's one of those movies that it would be so insanely difficult to do these today because of copyrights and licensing and the internet and all that craziness. But, you know, you look back and, you know, we were 8 years old when this came out, and we look back and look at it and go, that was a really huge movie to come out, you know? I mean, it had, obviously, the original character of Roger Rabbit, but then it also had, you know, Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny on screen at the same time.
I mean, how
you
cool
know?
Is that? I mean, it didn't mean much to an 8 year old, but watching it, you know, I've shown this movie to Chloe and stuff, and, you know, she's like, you know, cool cartoon stuff.
And, but, and it can know, be a really intense movie,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it can. Judge Doom is awesome. Good character.
Oh, yes.
Good character. But, yeah, no, to me, it's just it was mind-blowing, you know, as a 30-year-old to understand, you know, stuff like copyright laws and the bullshit that goes on between, you know, companies fighting over a nickel or whatever, and it was just kind of neat to see Mickey and Bugs Bunny on screen at the same time. But overall, just a good movie too.
Oh yeah, it's an awesome movie. I mean, I don't remember how many times I managed to see that in theaters.
I had the tape, and I watched it till it broke.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. It was an amazing movie. It had that great gumshoe thing going for it, and it's one of those movies you sort of go back and look at and you find yourself going, oh, that he was in that. That's right. And, you know, like I can't remember his name.
Bob Hoskins.
Yeah, Bob Hoskins and Christopher Lloyd.
Yep.
You know, and you go, really? Wow, you know? And that was Robert Zemeckis' movie.
First movie I ever saw Bob Hoskins in, and it was kind of funny, you know, working my way, you know, backwards to the fact that, like, you know, I saw him in other movies after that, and I'm all like, you know, man, that guy does a really good English accent, and he kept doing that really good English accent in all these movies after that. I'm like, no, actually, he does a really good American accent, and
yes.
It's just kind of funny because, you know, I don't know, I just. It was one of those weird things that was fun to discover because, you know, I always thought of Hoskins as Eddie Valiant. I never realized that he was like this guy with this really thick Cockney accent. It was just kind of funny to discover that. Yeah,
and I'm happy to see that it has a 98% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. 98.
Rating?
Yep, 98% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Well, it's a fantastic movie, and yeah, it doesn't have a very good DVD. or excuse me, it doesn't have a Blu-ray. The DVD is pretty good, but it's a in the fucking vault, so that sucks. But
yeah,
yeah, that too. It's my number six. It's one of those movies that I got for Christmas. I had the tape. I watched it till it broke. I still have it. You know, I would tape it back together and shit because you know the tape would break because I kept on watching it over and over and over again. But yeah, it's my number six. Something that's kind of noteworthy about my list. I don't know if it's noteworthy, but something that's noteworthy about my list is the fact that there is not a movie on this entire list that I did not see in the 1980s. Obviously, that's going to go away real soon. When we start getting into decades I wasn't alive in. But you know, none of these are movies that I discovered, you know, after the fact. These are all movies that I've grown up with, and so these are all movies that I'm you know very familiar with. I have at least 20-25 years knowledge of them. So that was my number six. So I guess we're moving on to your number five.
I suppose so. And jumping way up early in the decade as we talked a little bit about franchises and how the 80s was really sort of the birth of that franchise mentality. This is definitely one of those. It's Raiders of the Lost Ark, 1981. It had to show up on my list, and I had it on there.
Yep, it's a good movie.
It is a great movie, and it spawned three sequels and an iconic character that, you know, is still with us 30 years later that we just look back on and are happy to have.
And you dress like him for Halloween.
Exactly. And Raiders of the Lost Ark, what else can be said about that movie? It created a great series of films and a great genre of movie that you know really helped Steven Spielberg sort of push into that adventure film that he's so well known for, you know.
That's an excellent one. Believe it or not, it's not on my list. I do, you know, I love that movie. We've talked an awful lot about it. I fucking love Indiana Jones. It's a wonderful movie. It's a lot of fun, and it's a good choice. It is an excellently good choice. Okay, now moving on to my number five. My number five is one that I imagine, I guess it doesn't have to be, but I figured it might be on your list somewhere. But it's big, big, big time nostalgic, happy feeling movie for me. 1984, Ivan Reitman, Ghostbusters. It's a movie that I cannot even begin to tell you how many times I've seen it. You know, like if I had some way of, you know, getting the transcripts for my life and I had to guess what movie I've seen more than any other, I would be wondering if it was one of the it'd either be one of the Star Wars or it'd be Ghostbusters. I watched the shit out of this movie when it came out. Like I don't think I saw it in the theater. I might have, I might not have. I just can't recall. I definitely had a copy of it that was taped off a TV. I still remember the fucking commercials, and this is one that I watched until the damn thing broke. Wonderful movie. Obviously, you have Harold Ramis, Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, and Ernie Hudson playing the Ghostbusters. Introduction of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, who I believe showed up on my favorite movie Monsters when we did that years ago. It's just a movie that I love the shit out of it. I actually also really liked the cartoon. I've gone back and watched the cartoon, and it's not very good. But there were a couple of them that tied directly into the movie, and I thought that was pretty unique, especially for the 1980s, because that was all about just cranking out more and more and more stuff, and, you know, like any kind of, you know, connection to the movies, even if it's in retrospect, is...
Yeah, any kind of continuity was really rare.
But it was there, and it was cool to see. So it's a movie that I loved a lot. It's my number five.
Yeah, it's a great movie. It didn't. It ultimately didn't make the cut on my list. Say nothing bad to say about it. It's a great movie. But Ghostbusters has that great charm and sort of I was kind of blown away that I think it was done in 1984.
Yes.
And I thought it was later than that. A lot of movies that came out in the 80s were like that for me, that I'm like, really? That was that early?
Yeah.
But for the longest time, I only saw that movie edited for television, actually. And it was one of those that I saw, you know, 10, 15 years ago, finally unedited, you know, off of DVD. And I was like, wow, okay.
I do remember growing up and watching that that copy that I had on tape, you know, just, you know, many, many times. And then, like, then I saw it at some point later. I don't know if it was on VHS or... it probably wasn't on DVD or anything like that, but there was that scene with the ghost unzipping Ray's pants, and I was just like, "Holy shit! That's not something that was in the version that I grew up watching.
Yeah, in the TV version, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's wonderful. It's a movie I have a lot of fondness for, and I actually do. A lot of people like to talk shit on the sequel, but you know, I'm like, fuck you, I like the sequel. So
yeah, the sequel's, it's not great, but it's not terrible.
No, it's Ghostbusters 2. It's twice as good. And you know, when the movie came out, I was old enough to still have that means it's twice as good mentality. And so, you know, I have a little bit of I have a big soft spot in my heart for that one, and it's got Viggo in it, so that's always good.
He is Viggo.
Okay. I just talked Ghostbusters. Moving on to your number four.
All right, my number four is this is a movie that had a delayed effect. This is a movie that really didn't come. It came out, but it didn't actually explode out here until the 90s. It's a 1989 film, a John Woo movie, The Killer.
Ah, yeah, okay.
And this is one of those movies that I think you could take a look at and go, okay, this is the movie. I think this you could narrow it down to a couple different films, but I think really diametrically, it's this movie that changed action movies for the better, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it was a delayed effect. It took 10 years after this movie came out for American action movies to sort of catch up to it.
Yeah,
and there were a lot of attempts to do that, but America was stuck doing these sort of... In the 1980s, you had these cheesy action movies, and they were great in the 80s, but in the 90s, that got really stale. And places like Hong Kong with John Woo in this movie, The Killer, comes out with this just absolutely amazing way to do this, that it takes 10 years for America to figure it out that, oh, wait, this is the way that we should be doing this.
Right.
And The Killer has such a great... It's one of those movies that you could sit there and dissect because it has such great symbolism to it. And a lot of people would think now, especially with the movies that John Woo did in America in the 90s, that like going, yeah, but it's a John Woo movie. You know, he did Mission Impossible 2, and he did, you know, Broken Arrow and all that.
Yeah.
But I'm like, sit back and watch this movie and just watch the symbolism. If you know what you're looking for, this movie has a lot of great elements to it, and a lot of elements that really, especially at the time that this was made in 1989, just would blow your mind. And I know when the first time I saw it, it had the caption on it on the front of the box. It was like, one cop, one killer, 10,000 bullets. And that's really what the movie was, you know. But I think the best description I heard of it was this ballistic ballet. And that's what it was.
Mm-hmm. This is one that I did not see until well after the fact. How soon did it even make it over here?
I think it was probably 1991. It was really after. I just want to say Hard Target came out in 92 or 93. And this movie just had I remember renting it on VHS from Hastings.
Yeah, I actually bought this one blind. Somebody told me it was really good. It was, you know, I used to throw out, I'd throw away money. I was just had my, I think I was, God, 17, 18, 19 when I first saw this movie. And, this is one I just bought on DVD, on VHS for, I don't know, when too much, and it was really fucking good. I do remember being kind of bummed out at the ending because I just wasn't quite used to that kind of stuff, especially in this kind of movie. But at the same time, it was, you know, it was a wonderful movie. It's kind of hard to describe in a lot of ways. I mean, it's viciously violent. It's so symbolic. Mm-hmm. It's got a lot of things going on in it that you just don't expect from you certainly weren't expecting from an action movie in the 1980s, but even in the 1990s, yeah, it was kind of hard to take too.
It was released in the United States in 1990, September of 1990. But it came out in 1989. And so this movie, I think, is one of those really underrated special gems of the 1980s that came out and just was, it was the death knell that rang for 10 years of the 80s action movies. Because it was just so kinetic and so frantic, the pace of a movie that we look at it now, and it's like sort of like what Citizen Kane is to filmmaking, you know, nowadays, as people look at it, and it's it's all, it's like, oh, well, it's, you know, I've seen all that before. And it's like, well, back when this was made, you didn't see that.
Okay, very good. So at this point, we're moving on to my number four?
Yes.
Okay, my number four, you might want to be calling me a liar if you want, because I said I didn't have any hoity-toity, artsy-fartsy movies in here. But I do have one, I guess. But it's one that if you know me for any other time, you know that I've always been very very fond of. It's the 1984 Milos Forman Amadeus. Won Best Picture at the Oscars. You know, won Best Actor for F. Murray Abraham. It won Forman his second directing Oscar. Just an overall, it's a really, really excellent movie. I've talked about it a lot. I know it had to have come up on my best picture winners. I'm sure I've talked about it before, but it's a movie that I did see this one. I don't think I saw it when it came out, but I saw it, you know, right there around there, because I do know that I'd seen it before I was 10, because I know a lot of my friends were like, oh my God, your parents let you see that? I mean, that's got boobs in it. You know, why would your parents let you watch that? I'm like, well, I don't even remember there being boobs in it, but I do remember it being a movie about about Mozart. It's just, it's a wonderful movie, and it's one of those ones that, you know, the production design on that movie was just absolutely second to none. I mean, it was gorgeous. It had wonderful performances by both F. Murray Abraham and Tom Hulce. I know I've talked about feeling that, you know, while F. Murray Abraham certainly deserved that Oscar, I do think that Tom Hulce would have been just as deserving had he indeed won it as well. It's just a movie that it's an undertaking to watch. It seems like it's long. Like, fuck, I couldn't even begin to say 3 hours, something like that. It's a long movie. But it's a really good movie, and I've said it before. I really liked the way that it portrayed genius. I mean, there was just a lot there in Tom Hulce's performance that it wasn't necessarily in the script. It wasn't even in the script. It was just like little things. Like there's that great scene when Amadeus was sick, and he was transcribing music to Salieri, and he would be saying, okay, now you need B flat, Salieri, B flat. And there was just something there in the underpinnings of the way that this conversation was going down, to where you could see that his mind just worked faster than Salieri. It was just something I really appreciated. It's a movie that I love, and I always have you seen this one or not?
I have seen Amadeus. It's a great movie.
Yeah, it is.
But I think I've only seen it maybe twice. It's an amazing film. It is one of those movies I thought of as far as the 1980s, but it's not what, you know, spoke to me from the 1980s. It's a great movie. It's definitely one of those quintessential, I think, Oscar, 80s Oscar movies.
Yeah. I've said it before. It's one of those movies that, it's one of those movies that just shows that you're a sensitive film critic, because, you know, sure, you understand this movie, this great movie, and it's, I don't know, it's just a movie that I've always liked a lot, and it's, I'm not going to say I can't put my finger on it, but, you know, I've liked this movie since I was a kid, and this is not your typical kind of movie that a 7-8-year-old is going to watch. So, okay, so that's my number four.
Cool.
So, I guess we're moving on to yours, your number three.
My number three. It should be no surprise that this movie shows up on my list. 1982 Blade Runner.
Huh, okay.
Imagine that, you know.
Imagine that.
It's absolutely one of my favorite movies, and it's one of those that obviously I didn't see in the 1980s, actually. I didn't see until well into the 90s, and one that has decisively grown on me and that I've grown to really adore. And yet it's one of those movies that I think couldn't come out now, part of me wants to say that there are movies that have tried to be, it's like, oh, we're going to put out the new Blade Runner, you know, in the 90s, in the 2000s, or around the 2010s, but I don't think that anyone could replicate this one, especially, I don't think that a director would get away with making this movie nowadays. There was a lot of freedom and a lot of capability of a director like Ridley Scott to make a movie like Blade Runner back in 1982. Mm-hmm. And because of Star Wars and because of Star Trek, because they were still, studios were still beginning to understand special effects in these movies like this. And this is a movie they'd put out now that they insist on having umpteen sequels for and all that. And I just think it's just a perfect gem of a sci-fi, of a science fiction movie that sort of married perfectly that old aesthetic of those 1960s to 1970s noir films, sort of with that new science fiction that was coming out in the 1980s. And Blade Runner is just, to me, a gorgeous gemstone from that time period.
I'm actually kind of flabbergasted. This isn't your number one. This is a movie that I'm kind of embarrassed about my lack of my lack of exposure to. I've definitely seen it. I have
like any Ridley Scott DVD set. The DVDs have about 400 hours of extra stuff that are just amazing to look at.
I know. I'm not even sure I've seen all the cuts. I mean, I've definitely seen the theatrical cut, and I know I've seen the Deckard is a replicant cut. But you know, I bet you I've seen this movie in one cut form or another twice, maybe three times. And it's a highly stylized movie. I mean, that's what I walked away from it thinking. I mean, obviously there's some cool shit going on, but I really liked the way that this movie looked. I mean, there's an awful lot of cool shit going on with this movie. So, no, it's a good one. I don't really have much to add to it, but yeah, I kind of expected it to be your number one. So that's kind of strange. At this point, moving on to my number three. My number three is one that's just eking by. It's just eking by, meaning it came out in 1989. You know, the last couple of podcasts that we've been doing, you know, especially these decades ones, I've been putting a lot of thought into it. Mostly it comes down to the fact that I have time to think about it. You know, like this is a list that I've been thinking about for, you know, upwards of a month, something like that. And, well, it's the 1989 Steven Spielberg Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade for my number three. And, you know, a lot of people are like, well, of course, you have a fucking Indiana Jones movie in there. But
And it's my number 10.
The weird thing about it is it's not Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, because the more I think about it, the more I just prefer the Last Crusade. I mean, once again, you know, we say it often, don't let that take away from, you know, Raiders or Temple of Doom or whatever, you know, or as Monty Cook said it so eloquently, you know, praise of one thing is not criticism of another. So that's good. But this is a movie that I do really like. I liked watching I liked the relationship between Indy and his father. I liked the stuff going on with, I kind of liked the opening with him as a kid and then, you know, transitioning to him as an adult. You know, I will, you know, fully admit right here, right now, that if this had been the first one to come out, it wouldn't mean as much. You know, because it was kind of cool seeing Indiana Jones being like the, you know, the badass swashbuckler getting the girl all the way through these movies and, you know, things of that nature in the first two. But in this third one, you know, he's just kind of, you know, he's, you know, a kid, you know, because, you know, he's just kind of going after his, you know, father's approval. And he has a cold, distant father played by Sean Connery. And, you know, my favorite part in that movie has, you know, and it's been for a long time, is the whole thing with where, you know, they're hanging over the edge. The Nazi bitch had already fallen to her death and Indy's trying to go for the Grail. And he's trying to go for the Grail and he's about ready to fall over. Indy Sr. grabs Indy's wrist. Indy Sr., Dr. Jones, Henry Sr. grabs his wrist, and he's reaching forward. He's like, "I can get it, Dad. I can get it." And he says, "Let it go, Indiana." And that was just a cool little moment because through the whole movie, he's calling him Junior. But you know, in this part, he's like, "Let it go, Indiana." You know, it was just kind of like that neat little thing of father and son seeing eye to eye. And you know, it's a very humanistic moment. You know, because he chose, his son, his family over, you know, going for, you know, the fucking Holy Grail. I mean, that thing's like pretty important, I guess. It was cool. I picked it from number three because it's one of those things that, you know, my whole reconciliation thing and coming to terms with, you know, what I like, what I don't like, I realized that's my favorite of the Indiana Jones movies. Mm-hmm. So it's my number three.
Yeah, and that's interesting to look at because of with Spielberg, that's him sort of coming full circle of, you know, he started the decade off pretty much with Raiders of the Lost Ark and he ended it with Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and that Well, that's an interesting evolution from that movie to the third one there.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a great movie. I mean, The Last Crusade is easily, I'd say easily my personal favorite of the two. I rank Raiders higher just because that's the type of guy I am. I like to rank the first ones higher just because they started there. So.
Yeah, I used to be that kind of guy too, but the more I think about it, the more that, you know, like I was 9 when this movie came out. I mean, I explicitly remember the day I went to go see this movie. I went and saw this movie with my friend Joe. You know, we watched the movie, we had fun, we went to fucking McDonald's afterwards, we went out and did stuff afterwards.
I remember seeing a double feature of this in Star Trek V.
Oh, yeah. But, yeah, yes. It's just one that I came to terms with. I mean, again, I do love Raiders. I mean, I probably like Temple of Doom less than I like either of these. But I just really, really, really love this one. And first off, I really like Henry Jones Sr., maybe more than he deserves. But yeah, he's just a good character. So I picked it from a number 3.
That's a fantastic choice. A great movie.
Okay, very good. Moving on to your number 2.
My number 2, now we're getting into movies that are easily just, you know, I don't really care what people think of them. They're obviously my personal favorites. And this is a movie that we're talking about growing up with and loving. When some kids, when they're growing up, I mean, kids nowadays, they're growing up, they're playing Captain America, they're playing Spider-Man, they're playing Batman. In the 90s, it was really Batman. It was that sort of thing. But for me, when I was growing up, the movie that really influenced me and the one that I would go play make-believe was, I would run around with a Frisbee and pretend I was Tron.
Ah, yes.
And Tron is significant to me for that reason, and you know, more technically speaking, it's you know, that movie came out that had all these computer effects in it, and really started off this whole digital revolution in movies that Tron just was. And obviously it's one of those Disney movies I've got it on DVD. I really want to get it on Blu-ray before Disney decides to lock it back in the vault.
Don't they have a Legacy and a Tron box set, or not box set anymore?
Yes, but I've got Legacy on Blu-ray. I found it for like $10, and so I just need the first one now.
Uh-huh.
But Tron was just, I mean, that's one of the reasons I look, whenever I see, like, Bruce Boxleitner, I just smile, because, I mean, when I was a kid, he was one of my heroes. I mean, Tron was one of those heroes to me that I was like, I want to be as good as that guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, you look back at it on that movie now, and I think it just withstands the test of time. I mean, 30 years have gone by, and I think that movie still is good. It still has great elements to it. The effects, sure, you could look at it and go, yeah, the effects are kind of cheesy, but for 1982 and for what they were trying to do in that movie, I think they just did a great job, and I think they still stand up today. And I really wish when Legacy had come out that they had re-released Tron, you know, done a double feature or something like that.
I was surprised that they didn't, actually.
Yeah, sadly they just didn't, because I'd love to be able to see that movie on the big screen, especially in a nice digital remaster or something like that. I could care less about the 3D, but Tron is easily clocks in at my number 2, because it's just this great original film that just was this huge monolith to digital filmmaking and to digital effects, because you can all trace it back and go, it started here, and then this movie sort of evolved into the Jurassic Park, into the T-1000, into you know, all that great stuff.
Yeah, it's a definite starting point for all those things, without a doubt. I mean, it probably didn't have the influence that a lot of those movies did, but I mean, that's not to say it didn't have its whatever influence it does have, but at the same time, it didn't blow up as much as we'd like it to. I do know that we were both relatively big fans of Tron Legacy when it came out. One of the things that I liked about it was, you know, I would like to say the restraint that they showed in putting 20 years in between the original and the sequel, but at the same time, you know, it wasn't restraint so much as it was probably not being able to find the money for it. But it made for an interesting arc throughout the story, and that was cool. I mean, this is one that I did like, so good one.
Mm-hmm. And I'm with you as far as a sequel to Tron Legacy, that they should wait another 30 years.
Yeah, absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right, so what's your number two?
Moving on to my number two, I'm going to have to ask a favor of you. I would like to defer my number two because I want to talk about my number two and my number one at the same time. So do you want me to do that now, or do you want to talk your number one now and then let me get into my number two and my number one?
Well, since this is my decade, I'm going to go ahead and say you talk about your number two and your number one. We'll go from there.
Okay, that works for me. That works for me. Ethan, what are the two movies that are obviously conspicuously missing from this list so far, knowing me?
Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi.
No, you're right on one of them. Empire Strikes Back and The Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah.
Are the two movies that are conspicuously missing from my list so far.
Right.
Now... This is one that I'm glad I had some time to think about it because I was talking to – I think I was talking to Rachel about it at one point. I talked to Jesse about it, and I was about ready to put Empire Strikes Back as my number two and Little Shop of Horrors as my number one because I was starting to really think about the two of them. And I was, you know, I was saying, man, I really, really, really love Little Shop of Horrors. You know, that's a movie that just gets put into my DVD player to cheer myself up. You know, I mean, I love that movie. It came out a week after my birthday. I bought it the fucking day it came out on Blu-ray. And it's an awesome Blu-ray, and I love the restored original edition. It's just, you know, it's a great thing. That my movie, that my love of that movie is very, very, very well, you know, we got it on the ether. It's on wax. People know that I love that movie. Same deal with The Empire Strikes Back. And so I was really struggling with what I should do with this because I was really starting to think about, you know, I think I like The Little Shop of Horrors more than I like The Empire Strikes Back. And then Disney bought Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And I saw my reaction to what happened to that because I was just all like – I was so excited about that. I was – you know, it reminded me of my Miracle Video days of being online and just typing Star Wars into the search engine and seeing, you know, what I would come up with. And I was so excited about it. You know, I was all about the – you know, and I'm still all about the – you know, every time I see anything that's even remotely Star Wars news, like I saw a little news piece saying that Derek Jacobi wants to be in Episode 7. I'm like, fuck yeah, get Derek Jacobi in Star Wars anywhere. I don't care. But
yeah.
But you know, I'm just all, you know, usually I avoid stuff that isn't, you know, like hard fact. But this I was loving the you know, I'm loving the speculation. You know, you remember those Star Wars Episode II fan trailers where they had all the actors that were rumored but not actually in it, like Gabriel Byrne and Gary Oldman and shit like that. And I loved that shit when I was like 19 or 20. And you know, I'd since, you know, moved past it and I'm more looking at the firm. But it reminded me of a time in my life when I was really, really happy, you know, because I was all about that stuff, getting on and, you know, fucking convincing people I worked on the Star Wars set and that kind of stuff. And I realized that maybe, you know, maybe my love will cool, but it's like, you know, it's like a marriage, it's like a relationship. You know, you go through good times, you go through bad times, but it's always going to be my number one. So Empire Strikes Back is my number one, Little Shop of Horrors is my number two. But there was a scary couple of days there where I thought I was going to have to demote Empire Strikes Back as my favorite movie. Didn't happen. That news came out, I'm like, fuck yeah. First thing I did is I threw in the Empire Strikes Back, and I loved every second of it. And I don't even want to postulate how many times I've seen that movie. I just know it's a lot. And you know, it's, and I still love every fucking second of it. You know, I still laugh at, you know, like would it help if I get out and push? Maybe it would. You know, just shit like that, stuff I'm so absolutely familiar with. But you know, it's just part of who I am. It's, you know, part of how I became this movie dude that I am. Part of my, you know my pure nerddom that is Aaron. And you know, I get into arguments with people like, you know, your Doctor Who fans, your Lord of the Rings fans, your whatever fucking fan, you're comic book fans, and you know they're like, oh, you know, fuck Darth Vader. I'm all about Batman, or I'm all about, you know, like, you know, I like all that stuff too. Don't get me wrong, but it's always going to be Star Wars for me. So my number two, and I don't know if I should gloss over it as much as I did because I do absolutely adore it. It's The Little Shop of Horrors, the movie about the singing plant. Fuck you, Ethan. It's cool, but it's got great music in it. I'm not gonna call it a nice little story because it's a movie about fucking plants eating people. And, you know, but whatever. That's almost secondary to me because I like, you know, I really dug the music in it. And you know, it's, you know, you have Rick Moranis playing the role that he was fucking born to play. And you know, that's something kind of funny is Rick Moranis is in at least two of these movies that are off the top of my head that, you know, I'm just thinking about here. They're from the 1980s. He was, you know, kind of big in the 80s, I guess. It's a movie that I love. I mean, I love Little Shop of Horrors. It's my number two. My number one is obviously The Empire Strikes Back. If it's my favorite movie of all time, it's going to be my favorite, you know, film from the 80s. But, you know, it had to prove itself to me, and it did. So, yeah, I absolutely love both of those movies. So Little Shop of Horrors and The Empire Strikes Back. You have anything to add?
No, I think everything's been said at this point. I mean, my feelings on Little Shop are well known and documented, and Empire Strikes Back is a great movie. It's easily the best Star Wars movie in my opinion, and you know, what more can we say about it?
Not much. If it could be said, we've probably said it. Unless it's negative. True. Unless it's negative, and that hasn't been said, and it won't be.
All right. Well, I guess we're moving on to my number. We're finishing up with my number one.
Yep.
What movie is absent from my list?
It's either Batman or Superman, or
it's RoboCop.
RoboFuckingCop. Okay, yeah.
Because I'm sitting here thinking, you know, we're talking about the 80s, and I found myself looking at all the movies, and you know, I've said it many a time that RoboCop is a quintessentially a 1980s movie, and I don't think I've ever really explained that.
Go ahead.
RoboCop is one of those movies that a lot of people just sort of dismiss. It's like, oh, it's that RoboCop movie. It's the cyborg cop. Yeah, it's, you know, ultra-violent, whatever. But I'm like, you know, if you really put that into a film class, if I were teaching a film class, I would make my students watch this movie and evaluate it. Sit down and actually take it apart because of the time period it was done and sort of the themes in the movie. And it has, and it's actually a much deeper movie than people give it credit for. But it has that voodoo economics, that sort of what was going on politically in the 1980s was, you know, with business, and, you know, that was emulated in a movie like Wall Street, you know, but it's like, but they put this into a science fiction tilt of extremity with the crazy news and the, whether, you know, it's, you give us 60 seconds, we'll give you the world type of thing. And all these crazy TV shows and commercials and crazy, you know, what really those, I'd buy that for a dollar thing is just reality TV, and what that's what's going on now. I think that movie was very prophetic. It was very, very much a commentary on where society was heading. That you had these disconnected big business people, these people who never went below the 20th floor, and had oodles and oodles and oodles of money, and they're so disconnected that they say, "Well, we don't like the city, so we're just going to build a new one over here."
Right.
And it's like, well, crime is bad, so we're going to do this RoboCop thing, but we're a business, so we're making money, and so, you know, we're going to put this guy out there, and we're going to make money off of him. They really weren't focused on the aspect of law enforcement or anything like that, that they're like, you know, you really sit down and think about, like, the RoboCop's prime directives, you know, and they're so loose and vague, and it's obviously was thought up by some corporate guy who was like, yeah, we'll give him these three directives, they'll sound good, you know, can you just imagine him saying that on camera? It sounds really good. Mm-hmm. With the OCP logo on him and everything, this would be great. And it was that disconnected mentality that led to, you know, basically led to the problems that we have today. And I think RoboCop is one of those movies that you can sit down and really, really dissect and look at and go, what is this movie telling us about where society was going and what we were doing to ourselves and what we eventually did to ourselves? And I think RoboCop, in that way, is a quintessential 1980s movie, in that it's all about business going crazy. It's all about the insanity of entertainment and the ultra violence of, you know, the ultra violence of reality and sort of this over the top thing that's going on in that movie. So for me, I had to put RoboCop at number one.
Yeah, I don't know. If I was actually paying attention when you asked me that, I would have said RoboCop. But you kind of fucking threw me off because I was actually kind of expecting Blade Runner to be your number one. And then I was thinking, you know, I don't know. But, you know, no, yeah, fucking Robo fucking Cop. That's I know that you're very, very, very familiar with it. I like that movie a lot, too. It's one of those movies that, you know, I had a, I'm not going to say I had a weird upbringing, but, you know, my parents basically let me fucking watch what I wanted to watch, you know, like, you know, violence and nudity and stuff. I mean, I wasn't watching porn at six, unfortunately, but, you know, like, they, I was watching R-rated movies, you know, well before I was 18 and shit like that. And this is one of those movies that my parents got up and, you know, got into a huff about because, you know, oh, it's really fucking violent. You don't need to see it. And I saw it anyway. But, I mean, boy, it was pretty fucking violent, but that's not the point of the movie, and you're absolutely right that there is more going on here than this just being a stupid ass action flick. But at the same time, you know, that's our fear with this remake, right? That's yeah. Effectively what they're going to do is they're going to turn it into Batman with armor that doesn't come off or something, you know, something along those lines. So you know, they have some really good elements in that remake, but you know, I absolutely get your hesitation. I completely understand it.
And really, you know, I remember in high school one of my history teachers made us watch The Wizard of Oz, and then we sort of disassembled the movie and examined it as an allegory, and I think that an allegory for the time period. And I'm like looking at it going, you know, looking back now and saying, you know, you could do the exact same thing with RoboCop. And so it made it to my number one because I think it's a quintessential sort of microcosm of the 1980s.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Boiled down into, you know, a 90-minute movie.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why I just had to push it up to number one. And you know, all that aside, it's an awesome movie.
Yeah, it's
you know?
Also
I mean,
fucking Robo-fucking-Cop.
It's Robo-fucking-Cop, yeah.
We can wax poetic about it all we want, but at the same time, you know, he fucking stabs a guy in the neck with, like, a data connector. It's badass. Mm-hmm. And a guy gets melted with toxic waste, and, you know, there's all kinds of cool shit going
on. And, you know, I'm not one to sit there and analyze a movie and say, you know, oh, hey, well, here's what this director wanted to do with this.
Yeah.
But I do think this is something that, given like to a film theory class or something, that you could have a lot of fun dissecting it and really, really writing about what it could mean.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's a great one. Yeah, absolutely, good one, very good.
But
one.
Hey, it's my number one.
Okay, cool. Why don't we do some rundowns to stick a fork in this bitch?
Alrighty. Well, my number 10 was Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. My number 9 is The Princess Bride.
Uh-huh.
Number 8 is Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
There you go.
Number 7 is Aliens. Number 6 is Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Number 5 is Raiders of the Lost Ark. Number 4, The
Aliens,
Killer.
Huh?
Number 3.
Holy
what's
shit.
What's that?
I forgot about Aliens.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Number 4, The Killer. Number 3, Blade Runner. Number 2, Tron. And number 1, RoboCop.
Huh. Okay. Well, my number 10 is Airplane. My number 9 is definitely the only Tim Burton movie that's ever going to show up on any one of my lists is Beetlejuice. My number 8 is another Steven Spielberg movie, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Number 7 is Back to the Future. Number 6 is Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Number 5 is Ghostbusters. Number 4 is Amadeus. Number 3 is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Number 2 is The Little Shop of Horrors. And barely hanging on to its spot at number 1. I had to justify this one to myself, and it got scary for a minute, but 1980, Irvin Kershner, The Empire Strikes Back. Boom. 1980s, my friend.
Excellent.
Excellent.
I think... I hope we did that to everyone's satisfaction.
I hope we did too. The little bit that I've seen is people bitching about movies that aren't on here, but they can fuck off. These are our lists, not theirs.
They can get their own podcast.
They can make their own fucking podcast and talk about their own stupid 80s movies, but you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you got some John Hughes in there, so that I guess that's okay too. That's okay too. But do you have anything else to add before we before we stick a fork in this bitch, and then we're going to move on to Ruthoz, that bitch?
No, I think I think we are doing good.
I think we are doing good, too. Well, until next time. I don't know what we're doing next week. I'm not going to pretend that's stupid, because then it makes us, complicit. And, you know, if I say we're going to do something and then I can't, then it makes me a liar, and I'm not a fucking liar. But, okay, moving on. I'm Aaron.
I'm Ethan.
What?
Dead or alive, you are coming with me.
Dead or alive, you're coming with me. I'd buy that for $30.